We have three major conflicts right now for the United States. One of them that is much more important, and so it's a tragedy that's happening right now in Gaza, in Rafah. And when it comes to this tragedy that is happening right now before our eyes, how do you see the foreign policy of the United States toward Israel and toward what's going on in Gaza in Rafah?
I think that the genocide being committed by both Israel and the United States, the US is a full partner, enabling this, supplying the weapons, supplying the diplomatic cover, the financing, the intelligence. The US is a full partner in this genocide. It's absolutely outrageous. I see it, it is the moral imperative of our era. And certainly, it's the worst genocide, most intensive, and the most really brutal and accelerated such genocide known. And we are seeing it live streamed in real time. It is a real challenge, I think, to our core values. Who are we? What happens in Gaza isn't just about Gaza. First and foremost, Gaza's in the target hairs. But what goes in Gaza goes everywhere, basically. We're destroying human rights and international law. We're seeing them dismantled, and we are normalizing the torture and murder of children on an industrial scale. And it is incumbent on all of us to shut this down immediately.
In your opinion, what's the problem? Why the Biden administration is not capable to shut it down?
This is a commitment of US foreign policy, which has been longstanding. Ronald Reagan's Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger, described Israel as the unsinkable battleship for the United States in the Middle East. We at one time needed that oil, those fossil fuels. Now we don't. We are one of the world's leading exporter of fossil fuels, if not the leading exporter. We no longer need it for ourselves, but it's the US explicit foreign policy, as articulated by the Pentagon and related institutions, that the United States will be the unipolar, the monopolar power in the world. And for decades, that was true. It's no longer true. We've been losing major war after war. This is a disaster for the people of the world and for the United States. This is impoverishing us. It usurps half of our congressional discretionary budget. At the drop of a hat, Congress is appropriating, another 10, 20, 40, 60 billion dollars for the genocide being conducted by Israel and Ukraine as well, another needless, completely avoidable war that the US has been ginning up really for decades. So this is impoverishing us. We spend huge amounts of money at the blink of an eye to engage in endless wars, but by the tens of millions, the American people do not have the basic necessities of life. Half of all renters are extremely economically insecure, meet the criterion, of spending more than 30% of their income just to keep a roof over their heads. 44 million young people who are mired in student debt, which cannot be discharged in the current economy. 63% approximately of Americans who are living paycheck to paycheck, child poverty rates that have doubled in recent years, homelessness, which is at an all-time high. So the American people are paying, an extraordinary price. This is not simply a war that's over there. This is a war that is impoverishing us at home. And I mean the endless war machine. We already see the potential for this war to generalize into a war in the Middle East. Israel has just taken by military force the gate through which aid formally entered through which people could be exchanged, that border crossing has been essentially shut down by Israel. Egypt warned, you know, some months ago that if Israel did that, it would put at risk the whole peace treaty between Egypt and Israel. I haven't seen anything about that recently, but that is a concern. You have major rallies that were taking place in Jordan in recent days, clamoring also for an end to the peace agreement between Jordan and Israel as well. You know, some four or five countries that either Israel or the U.S. are now in active conflict with. It's not hard to see how this explodes, which is very much what Netanyahu is pushing for, because he wants to distract from this, you know, outrageous, brutal genocide, which is, you know, making Israel and the U.S. Pariah nations in the eyes of the world. So everything is wrong about this policy, and the American people oppose this by very large numbers consistently. So there is political will to end this right now. Joe Biden can simply pick up the phone. That's all he has to do, like Ronald Reagan did in the 1980s, telling Israel to bring its troops back from Lebanon, where they had pursued the PLO, which was kind of the Hamas back in the day, and told them to stop the missile strikes and the bombing. And it happened immediately. The missiles and bombs were called off. So Joe Biden has all the power in the world to put an end to it. It reflects, I think, the basic mindset. The U.S. still considers itself an empire and the sole dominant empire. And, you know, it is a matter of explicit Pentagon policy that was first articulated in the early to mid-1990s through a leak in the New York Times from Pentagon written policy that said that the United States essentially will crush any rising power, any competitor, and that we will dominate all potential spheres of conflict, whether it's the, you know, land battlefields or under the sea, the surface of the sea, cyberspace, outer space. The U.S. will be the sole dominant force, and we will not allow any competition to rise. This is a disaster in an era where the BRICS alliance has now exceeded in its economic power that of the U.S. and allies. So this is an extremely disastrous, foreign policy, which unfortunately still prevails. The name of that policy, as it was referred to, I think when it was first articulated, is full spectrum dominance, that the U.S. will assert full spectrum dominance over all potential areas of competition, especially military competition. And this is not a world that we can survive in.
Let's get to the conflict in Ukraine that is so much important. And we've seen Ukraine just melting and just being destroyed, devastated by this war. And at the same time, the Biden foreign policy in Ukraine doesn't seem to have any sort of modifications, any sort of changing. And how do you see the current face of conflict in Ukraine and what the United States can do to put an end to this conflict?
To put an end to the conflict, the United States can stop pouring gasoline on the fires. The United States has been ginning up this war since the mid-90s, really, when under Bill Clinton, NATO began to move to the east, violating a promise that the U.S. had made to Gorbachev that if he allowed Germany to be reunited, that NATO would not move one inch to the east of Germany. And, you know, that has been going on since the mid-90s against, you know, Russia crying foul. It was also contrary to what most experts on Eastern Europe and Russia have said all along, including our former ambassadors to Russia, that this was nuts. It didn't matter who was in power. The Russian people have been regularly assaulted across the Ukraine-Russia border. That's been really the site of entry for foreign troops from Napoleon, you know, right through the Second World War. And Russia has, in the Second World War, lost something like 27 million people to that invasion. So Russia's going to defend its borders in the same way that the United States does. In fact, you only need to look at what happened when Russia brought its nuclear missiles to Cuba in the 1960s, and the U.S. basically launched the nuclear weapons. They were in the air to basically say that we would not allow this to happen. And fortunately, Khrushchev and JFK had the good sense to sit down and negotiate, which is what Russia has been trying to do, and the U.S. has been steadfastly refusing to do, and has refused all efforts at negotiation for a long time. The U.S. had a role, a prominent role in the coup against the democratically elected leaders of Ukraine in 2014, because Ukraine basically, under that administration, was going to remain neutral, and the U.S. wouldn't tolerate it any more than they were going to tolerate Pakistan recently trying to remain neutral in that conflict, and instigated a coup against Imran Khan and essentially got him put into jail. You know, so this isn't like new. The U.S. does this, and there have been approximately 70 such regime change operations. And by all appearances, the coup in the Maidan, where Victoria Nuland, the assistant secretary of state, was there handing out cookies to the protesters in a protest that is very, you know, tied to the Ukrainian Nazis and their brutality. And investigations have suggested that that's where the violence was coming from, the violence that was instigated in order to basically force out the president of Ukraine at that time and bring in, you know, basically Victoria Nuland's handpicked representatives, which was revealed in an infamous phone conversation with Victoria Nuland and the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine at the time, who were deciding then who would be the next set of leaders for Ukraine. You know, so this was really U.S. intervention in a civil conflict that has been longstanding within Ukraine, but it blew up in 2014. And, you know, somewhere around 14 or 16,000 people in eastern Ukraine had been killed by the time Russia entered into the latest phase of that war. This is not a war that began with Putin's invasion, which, yes, is illegal and is murderous and is horrific, but there were so many opportunities to prevent this from blowing up, and the U.S. just kept turning the crank. Barack Obama knew better and did not want to send offensive weapons or take an active role in that area of the world, noting that that's Russia's border. They have, you know, they have a lot of people, they have a lot of arms, they have real stakes there, and we do not. And he was absolutely right in, you know, in his refusal to become engaged in that war. And, you know, his cautions have been proven absolutely correct, because, you know, it's just untold numbers of Ukrainians and Russians that are being killed. And there is no, you know, there's no way forward here. There is no plan. Ukraine continues to bleed out and continues to lose territory. So it only becomes more and more difficult to shut this down. But the U.S. can do that by agreeing to sit down and negotiate a binding agreement, you know, much like the Minsk Accords. It's not rocket science how to do this. We can, you know, ensure that Russia's borders are secure. At the time, Russia simply wanted neutrality from Ukraine, which would have been so simple to assure. It's a little more complicated now because Russia's gained a lot of territory. But, you know, even after the war was underway, Russia was willing to negotiate. Most recently, you have France. Oh, and I think it was the UK.
And United Kingdom. We had United Kingdom. We had Poland.
And the UK gave the thumbs up for using their weapons to actually attack inside of Russia. And other countries, at least France, because I know I've seen that recently, saying that they're going to send their troops, or they're contemplating sending their troops. So, you know, so this is further provoking Russia's defenses. And Putin, you know, is recently quoted as saying that he's considering the use of tactical nuclear weapons if they are, you know, if they're cornered. And this is so crazy to keep dragging this war on and accelerating the conflict. It's nuts. So, you know, again, this is an example of the U.S. behaving like we are the, you know, the unipolar power, the empire, the sole empire, calling the shots for the world. This is unbelievably dangerous. One nuclear armed submarine contains the equivalent of 5,000 Hiroshima bombs. That is enough to put us, and we have 14 such nuclear armed submarines. That's enough, just one of them is enough to put us into substantial nuclear winter that spells the end of civilization as we know it. So our criminal misleaders describe these as, oh, perhaps an exchange of tactical nuclear weapons. Tactical nuclear weapons are generally include weapons the size of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs. And so this is not insignificant. And this can take us all into nuclear winter. Nuclear war anywhere is a threat to all of us. And those weapons should be banned, which is the law of the land, based on the United Nations nuclear ban treaty, which the U.S. should be leading the way among the nuclear powers to sign that treaty. We are obliged to do that based on the non-proliferation treaty, which we are a party to, that requires the nuclear possessing countries to, you know, eliminate them as quickly as possible. So there's every reason for all of us to stand up and basically throw out these clueless war criminals who are putting all of our lives in danger right now.
How do you see right now the policy of this continuation of the war in Ukraine? Do you think that the main reason is this 2024 presidential election, or is something else?
It's hard to know what goes on in the mind of someone who's lost their humanity and someone who's essentially brain dead and heart dead and soul dead, and who really sold themselves to, you know, to corporations for the highest dollar. You know, all of the Democrats in Congress voted for this, you know, what was it, $60 billion, I think, for Ukraine.
$61 billion.
In lockstep, all of them. It just boggles the mind. Is there no one worth saving, you know, in the Democratic Party? It's like the story in the Old Testament of Sodom and Gomorrah, you know, before they're turned to salt. Is there no one there that is worth saving, you know? And you do have the sense that these parties are completely beyond redemption. They have lost their humanity. They have lost their minds. They have sold out to their political careers, and they are taking marching orders from, you know, from the war profiteers, from the weapons industry, which puts an enormous amount of not only money, they put a huge amount into lobbying, and they create these jobs programs, you know, which are then the claim to fame that intimidate even the likes of Bernie Sanders, who wouldn't stand up for most of his career against the war industry. You know, it's only recently that he has dared to object to the genocide without calling it a genocide. But, you know, it really, it co-opts, what can I say? Our political system recruits, you know, the lowest layer of humanity into the political process. And it's a shame. There's a quote from the former Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, that we have a choice between vast concentrations of wealth or democracy. Our country has sold out to vast concentrations of wealth, and that process has taken on a life of its own. So once you get concentrated wealth, it can buy more and more policies and become more and more concentrated and create then, you know, policies that are more and more corrupt. And I personally have long stopped thinking about how to reason with people who are corrupted beyond reason. And, you know, my goal as an activist, as a mother, as a medical doctor, you know, watching our health go down the tubes here, you know, and our future go down the tubes, I have long since stopped wasting time on trying to persuade people who really don't have, you know, the brain cells to be persuaded and don't have the heart to like make judgments based on values, but rather to speak to, you know, the American people who abhor this and they revile both of these candidates and their political parties. They are zombie candidates in zombie parties. They do not have even, you know, the vestiges of human responses and feelings and skills to dialogue, to have persuasion. They're taking marching orders from their donors. That's how the system works. It's really not worth spending time on, in my view, except to replace it. And I do believe that we have a perfect storm right now for challenging the system. And whether we actually get to the White House, which I wouldn't rule out for reasons we can discuss, or we simply create an alternative, which is a political alternative that people are clamoring for right now. I think it's 63%, according to the latest Gallup poll, which is done on a yearly basis. It's off the charts. The numbers are higher than ever. Look at the primary, the Democratic Party primary in New York State held 3 or 4 weeks ago. There was 12% uncommitted, which is a huge tribute to the uncommitted movement. But there was 83% no show compared to the numbers who turned out for Biden in an election that was also predetermined, you know, where basically Biden had already been coronated.
We've seen that in the United States, students are protesting against the policies in Gaza. And I've seen that you've been participating in these demonstrations and you've been arrested in these demonstrations. What was your experience protesting these policies?
So we had been doing a campaign event not far from the campus of Washington University in St. Louis, and some students had attended the event. And after the event, one of the students invited us to please come and just show support for the encampment, which I think had just been established that day. And we said, of course, you know, this is really the hope of the nation and the world that young people are rising up, you know, according to their conscience, but also according to our constitutional rights of free speech and the right to protest, as well as polls that said this is, you know, this is majority opinion, as well as the International Court of Justice that basically said this is the law of the land, that this genocide, you know, this plausible genocide must not go forward and we must do everything in our power to stop it. So, you know, it's an incredible tribute, I think, to students as representing our highest values as a nation and, you know, as a human civilization. They're doing exactly what needs to be done, both for human rights, international law, and democracy. They're doing the right thing. And how could anyone, I think, not support them? So we were only too happy to come to the campus, where students then asked us, would we please try to mediate with the administration and see if we could de-escalate the situation, which we did, along with several of the elected officials from St. Louis who were also there. And we went to, you know, the alderman, in fact, the chair of the alderman, the board of aldermen for St. Louis, and one of the other members, you know, and we tried to reason with the administrators, and the police were like, so on one occasion we could talk to them. When we tried to go back to talk to them, the police blocked us and threatened to arrest us for even simply trying to talk to the administrators. And that includes the elected officials. The president of the board of aldermen were also threatened with arrest simply for trying to talk. And then the students asked us to join their line encircling the encampment. And we said, of course, they are putting everything on the line, far more than, you know, someone in my stage of life where my career is already you know, behind me. I don't need those college credits. I don't have my tuition at stake. I'm not at risk for being, you know, blacklisted, which they are. All of this is being asserted against them. You know, their arrest records could be problematic. So we were, of course, you know, of course we're there for you. And we were kind of at the front of the line where the police brutally attacked using, and you may have seen the videos on circulating on social media, but they attacked with their bicycles raised as battering rams, basically right, you know, in our chests at, you know, almost at face level, where they were trying to knock us over. They were trying to knock us backwards. You know, it was a very vicious and disconcerting assault, during which one of the police yelled at me that I was something to the effect, I'm paraphrasing her, but I'm under arrest for assaulting a police officer, as they are basically attacking me with a bicycle used as a battering ram. And then we were, you know, knocked down, manhandled as we were, you know, rolled over and had our hands cuffed tightly, and then walked over to the paddy wagons, where when the first one was full, we were driven over to a processing center, at first in the university and then at the county jail. And eventually there were over 100 people that were arrested and brought in. And at some point during that arrest, well, actually, after the group was processed, I was separated from the group into a separate processing to be mugshot, fingerprinted, you know, medical admission exam, as if I was being admitted to the jail and was going to be kept there. But lo and behold, at the end of that process, I was released. But, you know, it was clear that I was being processed differently, apparently, with this seeming charge of assault, which is like, I think what the cops do when they are worried that they will be charged with assault. I think they just register counter charges. That's just my informal impression here, because it's evident for the world to see how we were under assault and were really being viciously attacked. I met one other person who was also being charged with assault. That is the history professor from the University of Illinois, who was simply taking pictures. And the video of him is absolutely horrifying. He was simply standing there, an elder gray gentleman who was not a part of the line. He was not a part of the encampment. He was simply documenting, which of course is a big threat to abusive cops. And he was assaulted by three or four cops at once who came out of nowhere. He couldn't even see them coming. I think he was just, you know, focused on his iPhone taking pictures. He was assaulted, knocked down, and then eventually dragged somewhat distant from the crowd, as if they were going to where they didn't think they would be observed. And they were doing knee drops on him, on his chest and what looked like his abdomen from a distance. And this, you know, this can be absolutely lethal and deadly. And he never arrested. He never resisted arrest. He never did anything, as can be seen from the video. He was simply brutally assaulted, as if these are some kind of sadistic, vicious cops who've been known to do such things in the past, who've been known to communicate in advance of policing protests, where they look forward to abusing and injuring people. And in fact, there have been some convictions in the St. Louis police forces based on their intending to injure and communicating in advance about, you know, looking forward to hurting people and abusing people. And it felt like that's what we were getting. And I do want to note here that the St. Louis police force is one of many that are now being systematically trained by the Israeli Defense Forces, now called the Israeli Occupation Forces, the really horrific, brutal, dehumanizing crowd management tactics that they use are commonplace and are part of these programs that have been taking place, I think, since 2011, at least. There was an article about this in Ebony Magazine after I don't remember the name of the case, but, you know, a really flagrant case of police abuse and shooting of an African-American in St. Louis. There was a evidence published about how the police had been training with the Israeli occupation forces. And this is a common program now that goes to many, perhaps even most states. And it's not only state police, it's also the FBI, it's ICE, you know, it's all of the law enforcement agencies now, which are kind of under the sway of these extremely fascistic policing techniques and instructions developed by the Israeli defense forces, I should say the Israeli occupation forces. So it's a sign of the times that this is being normalized. It's a sign of the times that our colleges are placing their donors, their Zionist donors, and presumably their contracts with, at St. Louis, the issue was Boeing, contracts with Boeing that have been traced to the slaughter going on in Gaza. So the students are entirely right and have enormous moral authority here to be saying, this ends here. We will not allow this over, you know, using our tuition dollars to be murdering innocent children, women, and civilians in Gaza. So this is unfortunately a commentary on our economy. It's a commentary on our colleges that they are now dependent on such you know, such sources of income, that they are prioritizing these, you know, maintaining massacres over the well-being and values of their students, refusing even to dialogue about it, at least in the case of Washington University, arresting students, you know, basically, you know, evicting them from their quarters and from their registration in the university. This is just an outrage, and it needs to be stopped. And when our government, you know, is leading the charge, it corrupts our culture, you know, every fiber of our culture, from our campuses to our police forces to our economy. So we need a whole scale transition here. We need a reboot. We need an economy that's consistent with our values and consistent with our democracy, where we can have debate and dialogue about these issues instead of trying to shut it down with this false accusation that this is anti-Semitism. This is not anti-Semitism whatsoever. As a person of Jewish background, you know, there's enormous respect. There's a you know, there's great religious diversity going on at these places. There's celebration of Jewish culture, you know, with the large Seder that was held at Columbia University. There's not a trace of anti-Semitism here. This is kind of the political repression that seeks to equate anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism. Zionism badly needs to be debated. It needs a lot of daylight shined upon it. So many Jews, like myself, are all raised within the culture of Zionism. And even if you're not an active Zionist, the assumptions of Zionism really surround you. These assumptions really predate the disclosures of the 1990s, where, you know, the archives, the National Archives in Israel, were declassified and were first, you know, analyzed by Israeli historians, who clarified that no, this has been all about ethnic cleansing and land theft and basically, you know, a terrorist attack on civilians from the get-go that hasn't been, you know, put it this way, Palestinians have been making this clear from the start. And now there's really clear evidence to show that even before the Nakba, you know, there were horrific human rights abuses and ethnic cleansing that had been going on for a while and was part of an intentional game plan to remove the occupants so that it could be claimed this is a land without a people. So a people without a land can come and just, you know, make good on this. That's absolutely false. And it is a betrayal of really the highest values of Judaism. Jews, Christians, and Muslims all live together for centuries in Palestine. There was no conflict until the Zionists came and began trying to throw everybody else out, including Jews, Christians, and Muslims altogether, and many of them left. The super Orthodox rabbis now point out that Zionism is anti-Judaism. In their words, Zionism is against the Jewish religion and it violates its core tenets as expressed in the Ten Commandments, namely that thou shalt not steal and thou shalt not kill. And this is fundamentally violated by the Zionist agenda, which puts everyone at risk. Yeah, just to add that it puts everyone at risk. You know, no one is more at risk from this than Jews themselves, who are, or I should say, than Zionists themselves. But they put all Jews in the target here is because, you know, they are claiming that this is the act of a Jewish state to commit this genocide. And unfortunately, you know, it is a Jewish state, but it doesn't represent Jews. You know, it's a Zionist state that represents Zionists. But the blame for that, unfortunately, gets generalized very quickly to all Jews. So Jews are very much at risk, as is really everyone in the Middle East who's very much at risk for this thing just exploding on us, which it very much has the potential to do, and which Bibi Netanyahu, you know, would like nothing better than.
When it comes to the reaction coming from the government, coming from the Speaker Johnson, he was trying to talk, to communicate with students at the Columbia University. And when he was talking, and you perceive how detached from reality he is, and what, and nobody knows what he's talking about. He was threatening students for protesting against these policies. And on the other hand, we have one Republican and the other Democrats, the former Speaker Nancy Pelosi, talking and just connecting these protests to Putin and Russia, and unbelievable what they're doing and why they're doing this. And what's the benefit coming out of this? Nobody gonna benefit from this, to connecting these people, these students, who are talking about Gaza, not talking about anything else, connecting them with Putin. How do you see these juvenile policies that have been run in Washington for years? These people are senior policymakers in the United States. How did you find their reaction to these protests?
Their reaction to the protests, you know, I think they're terrified, you know, and I think they are clutching at straws right now and saying anything to try to publicly, you know, denigrate, you know, to try to smear in any way that they can, you know, and I think they're going to keep doing that because the young people, you know, are not being talked out of their convictions. And I think the duopoly, both parties and their leadership, they're only throwing flames on the fire now. They're only encouraging the resistance by brutalizing the protesters, the peaceful protesters. You know, there was an academic association of professors that just came out, you know, condemning the treatment by the universities. I think the more harshly they crack down, the more cornered they are. You know, I think, and it's hard for them to back off because this is a fundamental tenet of empire, that we will dominate, that we will maintain our control over the oil supply in the Middle East through our perch via Israel. It's very hard for them to save face here and back down, but they're going to have to find a way to do it, you know, most immediately relating to the genocide and the weapons that are being sent, because people are only becoming more infuriated and the American public really understands this. No one is being talked into the absurdities that this is an act of Putin or, you know, or China or Iran. You know, they're just clutching at straws here to try to discourage people, but, you know, it's only having the opposite effect. And I would note here also another major development that I think really has them quaking in their boots is the fact that Starbucks, you know, has really tanked financially. that their profits are way down and their stock price, you know, has really taken a crash. And they're even acknowledging that this is because of their policies in the Middle East. They're not being real specific from what I've seen, but it's obvious what they're talking about, and that the pushback is now global. So, you know, I think it's really wonderful, and it's a tribute to this movement, the BDS movement, and really to just, in the same way that the student demonstrations now are going all over the world, this is an unstoppable movement. And I think we don't yet know exactly how far it goes, you know, but our goal as a political campaign is to ensure that this is a subject of political debate. That is why we are fighting very hard to get on the ballot in New York, which is arguably the most difficult state. This is where the empire, you know, is going all out to stop us. They had raised the petition signature requirement. They tripled it secretly, basically, as an attachment to a budget bill about 2 years ago without any public discussion. They basically made it impossible for independent candidates and third parties to get on the ballot. But we are really mobilizing to ensure that we are, because it's very important that Empire be challenged in this race. There are three candidates who are very, you know, well, two for certain, and probably RFK, because he has a ton of money. He can probably buy his way onto the ballot. So there will be two, maybe three pro-genocide, pro-war candidates who are on the ballot. And our campaign is the only one that is on track right now. We have 75% of the signatures that are needed. We're approaching about half of the states, but we have the biggest and most difficult states in that group. So if you look at actually the work that you need to do, 75% of that work is done behind us. So we are the one anti-genocide campaign that will be on the ballot to really force this challenge to Empire and demand that they be held to account. Because if they're held to account, you know, they're not going to be in power for very long. They have completely abused the American people, not only with their war machine, which is endless and disastrous, but the consequences of that to the American people here at home.
Dr. Stein, recently I talked with Ambassador Chas Freeman. He endorsed you on this podcast, and he said that he's going to vote for you. And yeah, there are a lot of people in our audience who are willing to vote for you, but they have no hope because of these two, a system of two parties that are dominating everything in the United States.
Political elite is conducting propaganda 24/7 to make you feel powerless, to make you feel like you have to act under their marching orders, whatever they are. But in reality, this is a democracy. We have a right to vote for who we choose. They try to keep competitors off the ballot, but we are on the ballot now, and we are on our way to completing that ballot drive so that we will be on the ballot everywhere. So all those old rules don't apply. We are a full competitor. We can win this race, and especially because there are three pro-genocide campaigns on the ballot. They will be splitting the pro-war, pro-genocide vote. We are the only campaign which is anti-war, anti-genocide, pro-worker. We are the only, and also, you know, that will address the climate emergency. We are the only such campaign. So there's one of us bringing together a lot of movements that are very powerful, including 68% of Americans, according to Reuters, that oppose this genocide. And, you know, 44 million young people who are locked into student debt with no way to fix it, you know, et cetera, half of renters who cannot afford to keep a roof over their heads. So there are so many people who will vote for us if we're on the ballot. And we are well on our way to being on the ballot. Once we're on the ballot, and it's New York, which is the major hurdle. But once we beat New York, the mainstream media will be forced to cover us. They're trying to avoid covering us right now. And we're not working on that because our first priority right now is getting on the ballot, getting that work done. But we are going to come out of left field here, like a bat out of hell, basically, for the empire, because we're going to be fairly unstoppable, given that there will be three of them and one of us. In a four-way race, it can be won with as little as 26% of the popular vote. We have run as high as 5%, 4% in national polls, but 8% in some of the state polls. And if you look at people 30 and under, we're running 22% in Wisconsin, for example. So we are beginning to break out now, even before the mainstream media has recognized us. Bernie Sanders was running 2 and 3% until he broke out well into the primary. So we are positioned now to be on the ballot across the country in a race which is actually winnable. Not only that, we can show a very strong showing, which will change the political landscape, but we actually have a real potential of winning. And let me just say that if you don't stand up and vote for what you want, you do not register on the political scale of anything anywhere. As Frederick Douglass, the abolitionist, said, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has and it never will. By voting for peace, against genocide, for an agenda for working people, for healthcare as a human right, by voting for what you want, we have a moral compass. Otherwise, democracy does not have a moral compass. If we're only voting against what we hate or what we fear, there is no direction. And we just sort of randomly, rotate between one greater evil and the other greater evil. And by the way, we do not have a lesser evil. You'd be very hard pressed to say which one is the lesser evil. You don't get much worse or much more fascistic than supporting genocide, which is really the hallmark of fascism. So Joe Biden, and to look at, these militarized riot troops that he's calling out, and supporting to shut down on peaceful protesters, forces that have been trained by the Israeli occupation forces, in settings like Cop City, which is approved and promoted by a democratic city council, and for which there are another 70 or so such plans in the works to be creating these militarized police forces all over the country as they are in the process of shutting down our rights to protest and our Fifth Amendment rights. So we don't have to wait for Donald Trump to come to fascism. Fascism is here. It's alive and well under both political parties. The question is, are we going to stand up and end it? Because we have the capacity not only to fight it, we have the capacity to end it. We have the moral high ground, we have the values that are shared by the American people, and we have really the election of a lifetime that can actually be won here and now by standing up and demanding the right thing. As Frederick Douglass said, power concedes nothing without that demand. You make that demand by voting for a candidate that represents you. And in the words of Alice Walker, the poet and novelist, the biggest way people give up power is by not knowing we have it to start with. We do have the power in this election if we dare to stand up and assert that power. It's time to take a lesson, from our younger generation, which always leads the way, whether, in the climate movement, in the women's movement, shutting down the war in Vietnam. It's always been the younger generation that has led the way forward, and the free speech movement, back in the era of the free speech movement at Berkeley in 1964, which was a struggle. It again was a struggle for our right. At that time, it was to talk about the civil rights movement, which the colleges were prohibiting be discussed even on campuses. And that's what that fight was about, So now we have another fight for our right to actually speak and challenge Zionism. That's fundamentally Zionism and empire, let me say, both of them. Our constitutional rights are critical here, and so is our peaceful future, which is really very much at stake. Our lives are are in our hands right now, because no one is going to do this for us. We are the ones we've been waiting for, and we can stand up and demand an America and a world that works for all of us. This is within our reach if we stand up with the courage of our convictions. So let's do it. And I urge people to go to jillstein2024.com and join the team. There are so many ways that you can help to push us over the over this barrier here in New York State. We then have a smaller battle to fight in Illinois. But from there on, it's mostly routine. And if you can't get out and help collect signatures, we gladly accept contributions, which can be made at the same URL, that will help ensure that we have a anti-genocide, anti-war, pro-worker, pro-human rights, pro-international law campaign on the ballot at a time when the American people are clamoring for it. We can win this together, and we can be actually unstoppable together.
Thank you, Dr. Stein, for being with us today. Great pleasure to talk with you and learn from you.
Likewise, so much. I really appreciate it. It's been great talking with you. Mm-hmm.